and welcome to another episode of Radio War Nerd. The date today is May 13th, 2026, and this is episode 606. I am the co-host, Mark Ames, in Western New York State, and you are listening to Radio War Nerd. Subscribe. Go to the Patreon page. Go to patreon.com/Radio War Nerd and support the show. Subscribe. And I'm on the line, of course, with the War Nerd, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, in southern Italy and nursing a sinus headache or just sinus issues, right, John?
Sinus issues.
Yeah.
But recently today, we had a scary moment because there was a series of booms, and this could be anything. You just jump to the thought that, oh, God, wait, does Iran have any plans for vengeance against Italy? I certainly hope not. But it's probably somebody dumping a big platform of concrete in the sea somewhere. Mm. At any rate, it just rattled the windows with no thunder to follow. And usually there's thunder after that. But it was a little unsettling.
Not an earthquake then, huh? Because you guys are also kind of in earthquake country.
Oh, yeah, we're definitely there. Yeah. But no, this didn't sound like it. It sounded like trolls of massive size rocking over the earth.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess sort of lucky for you, Giorgia Meloni, one of the few good things she's done, she did not support, I guess like most Europeans, did not support Trump's war in Iran, and in fact, and I am pretty sure has denied the use of bases as well. So Italy would be pretty low down on the list, and Iran has their hands full, you know, around them.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess they or Hezbollah hit, or maybe the Iraqis. Somebody hit Cyprus with a few drones early on in the war, kind of demonstrated they could hit those British bases, but that's about all of Europe so far anyway. That was
right.
This hit.
No, I don't really think there's anything going on in the world that has anything to do with our local phenomena of sound, as Stevens would say. But it's interesting because your thinking process changes. Like if you've been reading about Trump and Iran and all this really lame nonsense going on, then your mind goes to possible explanations.
And yeah.
It's an uncomfortable process.
Well, there was, I mean, in your general area in the Mediterranean, but this is more off Spain, there was this is the end of 2024, I think, the very end of 2024, a Russian ship, a kind of a, I don't know, some sort of old rusty-looking cargo-ish ship was sunk, I believe, or definitely was hit by what's believed to be some kind of torpedoes based on the damage. And there just came out some articles about people assume that the Ukrainians were probably behind it, except that the kind of missile, the sort of the super cavitating torpedo, sorry, not a missile torpedo. It's a very high speed. It has to do with, like, I think, you know, it sends out bubbles in order to reduce water resistance. And based on the damage to the ship's hull, it was believed to be a super cavitating torpedo. But the thing is, Ukrainians don't have that sort of torpedo. Only the U.S., Russia, a couple other unnamed NATO allies, when I look this up, and Iran has a pretty, you know, we've talked about this going back to, I think, the first emergency episode on a potential war with Iran after Soleimani was killed. But we've talked about, you know, Iran has figured out how to make the Persian Gulf, the Strait of Hormuz in particular, hell for anybody who decides to invade. And torpedoes, missiles, drones, speedboats, these are all part of its asymmetrical, you know.
Which is why, as we've said before, but I think it bears repeating, which is why successive American administrations dovish or hawkish or whatever, declined to go into that bear trap. And they realized, no, there are too many ways of destroying enemy ships in that area. And unsurprisingly, Trump said, you know, along with a witch's brew of Hegseth and Netanyahu, we'll do it because we have the can-do spirit or something. Yeah,
because we're badasses, because we're not afraid. And other people, everybody else's problem is they were afraid. They were held back
perfectly sensibly.
They were held back by the woke mind virus, and we're not woke.
The woke mind virus was telling them, no, don't go in there because those dogs are all rabid and they're not in a good mood. Yeah. And boom.
Yeah. So just to finish up the Russian ship story, they just now, and I don't know why now and why it's being released, but stories have just been kind of from, I'm sure, friendly intelligence, military agencies, whatever, planted in Western media that the reason that ship was taken down was because it was supposedly transporting two sort of nuclear engines that would be used for submarines. And the Russians were shipping them to North Korea. And there was definitely some strange cargo on it. They described these like large manhole-looking things. I don't know. Immediately after the explosion, Russian warships, and they don't usually do this, kind of rushed to the scene and protected it until they extracted the ship and whatever was there.
I guess they don't want another Glomar Explorer.
Yes, exactly. But on the other hand, Russia shares a border with North Korea. So it's kind of strange that they would be transporting, you know, and opening themselves up to so much vulnerability. But maybe there's no other way. Maybe land, for whatever reason, there's no way to transport it over the land border with North Korea. If this is true, you know, the other likely possibility is just that this is a cover story, that the Russians were transporting something and were not being told, and maybe the Western side knows or had some suspicion and isn't telling, but for whatever reason, they've decided to tell this story. I mean, I was thinking maybe they were actually shipping something to, you know, the Houthis or something to Iran or, you know, who knows? But this is the story that's out there right now. And that probably caused an explosion. And it made me, when you told me about the booms that you heard, it just made me think of this story that just came out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are Russian vessels supposedly decommissioned or in the process of being decommissioned all over the world, or at least there were in my time at Dunedin, way down at the end of the world, so remote that it's featured in several H.P. Lovecraft stories. The port had at least a couple of Russian derelict fishing craft. And, you know, if you grew up during the Cold War, Russian fishing craft were supposedly like the haunted house exhibits at your local Halloween, because they were cover for anything. And I'm sure many of them were. So who knows what it was?
I mean, everybody uses civilian cover for stuff. And but they're always trying to scare us. I mean, the beluga whale was supposedly, I don't know if you remember the Scandinavians freaking out about beluga whales being programmed by Russia to spy on them. And, you know, there are so many stories like that. All right, so let's get into, you know, the world of wars. I guess we can start off, why don't we start off with what's still the big war, the Iran war. And one of the, and the period of ceasefire that we are in right now, but a story that just broke out this morning, and it's very relevant to all of this for obvious reasons, is that the producer price index is just a big gauge of inflation in the U.S. The numbers just came out, and it was massively higher than even sort of not necessarily Trump-friendly, whatever. The economists analysts did not expect it to be anywhere near this high. It's the highest level going back years to sort of the peak of the worst Biden years. Arguably, based on some metrics, even higher than that. And the way that they weighted, and they have their basket, you know, and we include housing prices and prices in the grocery stores. And then you can strip out just what they call the more volatile food and gas to see if inflation is spreading to other parts of the economy. But this is at the producer level. So this lags by about 3 months what consumers feel. So this is what we're getting now, because Consumer Price Index came out, I don't know, within the last couple of days. And that also went up to higher than any level since, I think, early 2023. But this is the whole thing that Trump ran on and won on was no wars and no more inflation. Like, those are the two main things, and here he gave it to us. So the consumer price is what we're already feeling. The producer price index is what we will feel in 2 to 3 months, because it's what the people who are making the products, what they're having to pay to make them now, you know, which then gets further down. And you know, it's a very, we're still in this weird limbo. I mean, prices for gas here where I live are sort of, it's between like $4.50 and $4.80 a gallon. And just like February, you know, 27th, it was like $2.80 a gallon, $2.90 a gallon, maybe $3. So that's a really large, that's a Biden level. In fact, I think it's steeper than what happened under Biden in terms of just the steepness. But we have an actual shortage coming around the corner. And I think that what happened in Biden was a combination. It was sort of like it hit at the same time. It's sort of like two waves hit at the same time and make a bigger wave, because it was coming out of COVID and all of these, you know, supply shocks and shortages from that were, and all sort of the backlogs. And also people had more money then, because for a while, there was a moratorium in the U.S. on having to pay off debts, like student loan debts. And a lot of people got put, including us, got put on better Medicaid health care. Like, a lot more people got cheap health care, basically. So you had more money to spend and fewer items. And so prices kind of went up. And then you had the Russian invasion. And this time around, you actually, you know, you didn't have much of the first problem. You didn't have like a supply shock.
Well, let me ask you this. It's like, as an outside observer, it seemed to me that after a lot of rage being generated by financial pundits, basically over Biden, and I'm not a Biden fan by any means, but there was a kind of patience with Trump, and it was as if they were doing everything they could to delay the impact of this loss of oil from Iran.
I actually see things a little differently. So I just remember, and maybe it just has to do with what media, you know, you pay attention to. But I just remember that as 22 turned into 23 and 24, and people increasingly were telling pollsters that they were hurting, and the economy was bad for them. But the numbers, the raw numbers under Biden were showing GDP growth. And, you know, he had these big bills passed that, like, big infrastructure projects that everybody was supposedly going to immediately benefit from. But at the same time, what he was actually doing was ending these emergency programs that were kind of like the first taste ever, for me anyway, in my lifetime, of a kind of social welfare state. Like, again, you know, we had really well-subsidized healthcare, so it wasn't as big of a problem for the first time since moving back here. People, for a while, they didn't have to pay back their student loans. Like, suddenly, the crushing debt was less crushing for about 1 or 2 years. We also got child tax credits, and then they just pulled them one by one. So prices were going up. You know, the numbers look good, but people actually wound up having to pay more and bring out their credit cards and rack up more debt to keep getting by again. And there were people like Paul Krugman and these other economists saying, basically, Americans are stupid and they're being hoodwinked by the media, the anti-Biden media, fooled into believing that their situation is worse than it really is. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of that. And then Trump comes to power and he starts doing that too. He's saying that the affordability crisis is a hoax. And you just deny what, you know, the people are actually going through, what the lived experiences they say is.
Didn't he sort of run on the horror of high prices?
Yes, he did. And the horror of wars. And he got us into a war and prices are going up. So he's just denying it. And yesterday he was asked how much he considers Americans' financial situation, you know, as he's negotiating, such as he is, with Iran. And I'll read you the quote. He says, "Not even a little bit. The only thing that matters is they can't have a nuclear weapon. I don't think about Americans' financial situation. I don't think about anybody." And, you know, these things were like funny a while ago. They're not funny anymore. Bully asshole act. It's so tiresome, and especially when you lose.
It really is. I tried basically ignoring Trump as long as I could.
Yeah.
Because he's just so tedious.
Yes.
But he can't be ignored forever.
They all are. The whole MAGA world, like their version of annoying woke, and woke was extremely annoying, all the, you know, virtue signaling and all that stuff. They have their own virtue signaling, which is if anybody criticizes you, call them a fucking retard, you know, et cetera, et cetera, a stupid pussy, low IQ brain retard. And it's just the inverse side of the same stupid performative rhetoric, you know, and it's infuriating and enraging when they're screwing everything up. I mean, it's just, and they're not even pretending to do good either. They're just, they literally are performing. At least woke is trying in general to do something good for people who don't have much. Like, you know, I mean, there's a lot of performance.
I think they are actively trying to do evil.
Mm-hmm. So getting back to Iran, we're dealing constantly with this up and down. I mean, part of it's market manipulation, but, you know, I think at this point we can just say this is just how the Trump administration rolls in a situation that they can't control, which is he and they will claim that we're on the verge of a deal and the deal's about to happen. And then also leaking or saying outright that the deal that Iran is agreeing to is everything we want, because they were completely defeated and decimated. And then Iran, and if they don't take it, they're all going to die and the whole place will be wiped out.
There was one particularly memorable utterance from Trump. It sounded like something from ancient Greek rhetoric, like a major civilization may die tonight. And then Trump had to ruin it all by adding, "It probably will, but we still have hope." And then that turned out to be just another one of his idiotic moves in the old American game, which has been played for decades. First of all, as far as I remember, by Nixon against the Vietnamese, of am I crazy or am I not? Mm-hmm. And Nixon at least had some real suspense going on there. Like, he never seemed very crazy. Trump actually is crazy, but not in a way that yields any particular policy. He's just generally an unpleasant person.
Well, and also, if the thing is, if the U.S. does what its sort of maximalist, sub-nuclear weapon kind of maximalist attack that Trump has been threatening, if they do that, the Vietnamese could not respond by, let's say, completely destroying and decimating the economies of Western Europe. Or, you know, the wealthy economies and the American economy. Like, there was, when Nixon bombed Hanoi, the North Vietnamese couldn't do a whole lot necessarily to the U.S. and the U.S. way of life. And this is so different with Iran. And Iran knows it, and they've already demonstrated it repeatedly, how much damage they could cause, how much more damage they could cause. They have, you know, they've not even begun to cause global economic damage if they want to by wiping, by, for example, just wiping out the rest of Qatar's LNG infrastructure, wiping out Saudi Arabia's east-west pipeline. Like that would just, and then mining the rest of Hormuz. Like that would just do it. They haven't done these things, but they've demonstrated their capabilities and already caused a certain amount of damage to give credibility to their threats. And so Trump's threats, it's sort of like, well, if you're going to do it, you know, then we're all going to go down together. And if you're willing to go down with us, then that's the way it kind of is going to go, and we'll see what happens.
Well, you know, I saw a data point, I guess you would call it, that was intriguing because it shows what a real brinksmanship strategy would be. And as far as I know, it isn't being talked about much. But according to this stat, 90% of China's power production depends on LNG from the Gulf. Suppose you try to kill two very, very large and menacing birds with one stone and just destroy everything in the Gulf by way of destroying the Chinese industrial base. I mean, I would think there is
I don't
an
think
office.
That's a I don't think that's a true I'm pretty sure now I'm just looking it up. Like for example, Japan gets 90% of its LNG of its natural gas, liquefied natural gas from the Gulf. China has all kinds of reserves.
Yeah, okay.
Renewables. I mean, it's the world leader in renewables, solar,
right.
And hydro. It does get oil from Iran and probably oil products from Iran. And it does get LNG, but it also gets an enormous amount from Russia.
So it would destroy the American
exactly.
satellite economies
exactly.
around the periphery.
In fact, China has been, first it stopped exports of its fossil fuels and products briefly, but it's exporting a lot. Of I don't know exactly what oil and gas or products. It also has a lot of coal plants, by the way, and a huge, huge reserves of coal for itself. And that's why it's trying to transition away from it to renewables. But they're actually exporting through this. In fact, because China's exporting through this, one of the reasons why oil and gas, or let's say oil in particular, hasn't gone through the roof as it should, because you know, there's still like 1,000 tankers still bottled up inside the Gulf and barely anything is going in and out.
They make very pretty abstract art, by the way.
Yeah. One of the reasons why it's at, let's say, $100, $110 a barrel now rather than $150 or $200 is because, well, there's definitely market manipulation going on. Bessent made his nut as a Soros trader, a currency manipulator, basically. So they're manipulating the markets to some degree, but they're also, China is exporting and the U.S. is exporting an enormous amount of oil and gas. And in fact, so what the U.S. is doing, we have strategic reserves in case of a war with China or something. So you have all this oil and gas reserves stored up in case everything's cut off, although we're also big producers. The U.S. is flooding the market with strategic reserves. They've never been depleted as fast as they are now, ever in history. And then selling that on world markets, so making a lot of money for the oil and gas companies, but also keeping the price from going a lot higher than it's already gone. And that's going
to
run out.
That might be a partial answer to what I was wondering about. Like, why hasn't the price spiked more?
Yeah. But that game is coming to an end soon, and we are on the verge of shortages in certain products. Like, for example, there's this guy, and it looks to be true. You know, you can never quite tell in social media, but he made a pretty good case, and now I'm starting to see it in kind of more respectable business media. There's a guy who's kind of a big player in the oil lubricants business. So, like, you know, 10-weight 40 oil, 10-weight 30, whatever, you know, the oil you put in your car.
Yeah.
Those kind of oil lubricants. And he said that there's basically about a 2 to 3 week supply left, and then we're going to have massive shortages. And it's not priced in. And everybody, so there was just a JP Morgan report on where they expect oil prices to be, why they are where they are right now, and where they'll be through the rest of 2026. And they estimated that the price will stay roughly, I think, the same, that the average price for the rest of the year is going to be somewhere between sort of 90 a barrel to 105 or maybe 100 a barrel, something like that. And then they said why, what their major assumption is for this. And the major assumption is in June, sometime in early June, all the oil tankers, everything that was like shipped out before February 28th has reached their ports and has already circulated through refineries and has moved around and so on. But by June, an actual physical shortage is going to start kicking in. And the shortage will be kind of like parabolically steep as every day goes by. It's going to get worse and worse. And what they wrote in the report was, Trump knows this, and there's no way that he can allow this to happen. So we're assuming that he cuts any peace deal, let's say by June 1st is what they said, but it might be some other time in June, because the consequences would be so catastrophic to the global economy as well as to his presidency that he has no choice. But again, look at the situation he's in. I mean, I think the current situation, which is neither war nor peace, basically not moving except doing these little, trying to, you know, jig the system that is in place right now a little bit with stupid Project Freedom and the blockade and whatever other idiocies, that this suits Trump better, not really moving from this, because to settle it, as J.P. Morgan says is for sure going to happen, that means Trump will have to agree to capitulate. The Iranians have not budged on their demands.
No, that is the, for me, the real shock here. Like, Trump figured he was dealing with another Venezuela.
Yeah.
You could only figure that, by the way, if you were an absolute idiot.
Yes.
But he is, and he did figure that.
Yeah. Yeah, it turned out his will couldn't, or as you said, his will to power, his will, whatever, could not overcome terrestrial geography and a population of almost 100 million people, and you know, who are used to being targeted over many, many years and sanctioned and everything. Like, it's what Trump's thinking is just a whole nother story. But so if the only way for him to get that peace deal, it's clear, is to capitulate. If he capitulates, this will be the end of him and his presidency, and he'll be thrashed for it. It's what he should do, because he's the one who screwed up and got us into the war. He should sacrifice himself for the good of the nation and the country. But do you think Donald Trump sacrifices himself for anybody?
No. Yeah. But I mean, I can see him sacrificing Israel.
Yes.
He might do that.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I wonder if he'll ever get... That would be the smart nationalist move, were he like that.
Yeah.
But it would be very, you know, it is what the Trumpoids and kind of ex-Trumpoids are doing. They're trying to say, poor Donald Trump was snookered, hoodwinked by Netanyahu. Now, Netanyahu has tried hoodwinking and snookering every president before him.
Yeah.
So Donald Trump had a little bit of agency there. He, you know.
Yeah. It is not his, as it were, first rodeo. But he might. I mean,
I really think this is also a generational thing. And, you know, here you have somebody who made his money in New York and his resentments are in New York and so on. But like, his Trump is from a milieu and a generation that really likes Zionists, successful, powerful Jews and Zionists. I think it's as Biden does, for somewhat different reasons. Trump's Jews and Zionists were sort of a different world, somewhat from Biden's. But these are both people who made it, you know, to the very top of power and so on. And people up there love their powerful Jews. I mean, I don't know how else to say it. And so I think it would be, it, it, it for him to turn on Jews would almost be like, you know, just one step away from him converting to Islam or something. Like, right. it's very hard for him to do. And the Machiavellian thing would be to do that, to say Israel snookered me, you know, and we are now cutting all weapons to Israel and, you know, they've harmed America. Like, to really do some dark shit like that, it would help him and it'd be a way out. But I just don't see him doing that.
And then the other option,
of course, would be to try to actually win the war, because he's lost it. In fact, a poll just came out a couple days ago from YouGov that showed that it was, I think, 61% of Americans said the U.S. lost the war, and only 13% said the U.S. won. And, you know, that same YouGov...
I'd love to interview that 13%.
Oh, I see it on social media. It's kind of mind-blowing. It's, you know, it's sort of... It's like a concentrated version of what you saw with Iraq war diehards and neocons from, let's say, mid-2004 until about 2007 or, you know, early 2008, when most of them started to abandon it. But there was a two-year period when your Victor David Hansons and stuff were, they were clinging on because people don't like admitting that they were suckered. It's very hard, and we're all like that, and it's very hard. I'm kind of impressed that only 13% said we won.
That's true.
But yeah, the other option, of course, is just to go to war and to win militarily, and that would involve collapsing the global economy. I mean, in neither case does J.P. Morgan's, you know, assumption really hold up. Now, they might know something, I don't know. They might be right. Trump might have some brilliant flea flicker in the way, you know. I don't know. But it's just hard for me to see. I mean, one thing we did kind of call right in the show early on, during the war, when it looked like maybe Trump was trying to get out of it, was how could he possibly get out of it? Because he'll have to capitulate. Yeah. And we did not expect him to capitulate. But what he did was he capitulated and then went back in his capitulation the minute he kind of reset the table a little bit. He went back on it and did his blockade.
So Trump is just someone who is much worse than either of us. So.
Yes. Yeah, but like...
Not bad.
But that's where he is right now. He capitulated and went back on it. So if he capitulates again and goes back on it, he's just where he is right now with the Strait of Hormuz closed. Like, it's not like the Iranians are fooled, you know? I mean, everybody knows we lost. The strait is still closed, and somehow, like, so he capitulated for a second, thinking I can capitulate, reset it because I promised to wipe out their civilization, and I got to do something now. So, you know, I'll capitulate, then say, actually, I won. But the problem is still the same. The Strait of Hormuz is closed, and Iran can't be defeated. And now the news that's coming out, and I'm not sure. This is being leaked by the U.S. intelligence community to the Washington Post and to the New York Times because they want this out there. And what's being leaked, first it was through the Washington Post. The Washington Post article, this was on May 7th. John Hudson, who's a really good reporter, I've been following for a couple of years now. He's got one of the bylines on this. But point number one was that Iran could endure this blockade that Trump put on them that was supposedly going to cause their oil pipelines to explode and their economy to collapse in 3 days or 13 days or 2 weeks. They keep changing it. U.S. intelligence says that it won't really begin to pinch for 3 to 4 months. I mean, in a bad way. And that's at the earliest. And the global economy can't handle that. According to the WaPo story, Iran has retained 75% of its pre-war inventories of mobile launchers, which the Israelis and Hegseth and so on had claimed had been completely wiped out. 90%, 95%, 98% wiped out. 75% of their inventories they still have it, and 70% of their pre-war stockpiles of missiles.
Yeah,
I would actually bet that it's even higher. But that's still pretty bad. I actually think I think we massively undercounted how many missiles Iran has. Like, I remember seeing...
And overcounted those destroyed, right? You were talking
about the
Serbian story.
Yeah, so I'll get to that in a second. Because the New York Times just yesterday ran a big piece that said Iran has restored operational access to 30 of the 33 missile sites that it has along the Strait of Hormuz. So basically, all their missile capabilities in the most strategic area of Iran are all completely functional. That, you know, and then again, 70% of their mobile launchers and their missile stockpile. And actually, they think Iran has regained access to 90% of its underground missile storage and launch facilities nationwide. So whatever we sort of bombed, they would immediately unbomb, you know. And I'll get to the fact that I think we bombed mostly dummies, basically. But this is an interesting, I don't know if this is true, but it rings very true from an account on Twitter, a round letter, and it describes how this may have happened. One of Iran's underground missile bases near Esfahan was reportedly struck nearly 20 times during the war, averaging one attack every 2 days using bunker-busting munitions and precision strikes from B-2 and B-52 aircraft, according to regional reporting. Despite the intensity of the bombardment, the site is said to have resumed operations within hours each time, with reports indicating it rarely remained inactive for more than half a day. A resident in Esfahan described repeated night strikes on the surrounding mountains, saying missiles were still seen launching from the same area the following morning. So this all brought me back. I mean, when we were still allowed, when our free media and government allowed us to see some satellite photos of bases being hit and so on, there were maybe it was even some Israeli video, but it was clear that already during the hot war that they were hitting paint, mm-hmm. you know, painted whatever, and dummies.
Yeah, there's a whole big industry in inflatable fighter planes.
Yes, exactly. And this is what I remember during the whole Russiagate panic. The New York Times won a Pulitzer for a series that they called The Russian Dark Arts. And one of the big dark arts was maskirovka. Because that they're Asiatic, they do things that you know, confuse us.
We would never do.
We would never have inflatable ships and do a false landing north of Normandy because we're good white Protestants. And we're just too darn honest. Yeah, this reminded me a lot of what happened in the Kosovo War. And I remember this, you know, we reported a lot on the Kosovo War at the Exile way back then. And during the war, you had, U.S. and NATO militaries just every day to a media that was absolutely cheering them on uncritically the entire time, reporting about how many pieces every day they were taking out, these pieces, those pieces, artillery, tanks, armored vehicles. They'd completely decimated the Serbian military, you know, 20 times over. Well, after the war ended, there was a report that was leaked to the media, and an Air Force report. It was suppressed, and somebody leaked it out. The U.S. had claimed we took out in 78 days of bombing or something. The U.S. and NATO claimed they took out 120 Serbian tanks. In reality, they took out only 14 tanks. The rest were wooden dummies. We claimed we took out 220 armored personnel carriers. In reality, only 18. We claimed we took out 450 artillery pieces. In reality, only 20.
Wow.
So, it's out of the 744, quote, confirmed, unquote, strikes by NATO pilots, they found evidence of just 58 hits. So that's less than 10% were actual hits.
Wow. And there was one attack that was definitely confirmed, and that was the shooting down of an F-117 stealth jet, which the USAF and U.S. Navy had contributed hundreds of billions of dollars to.
Yeah,
I mean, that stealth tech, I'm sure parts of it made its way to China or any other customer that wanted it. I mean, you come across something that is more valuable than, much more valuable at that point than gold, and you're a wretched Serbian peasant, I think you're going to sell it.
Oh, yeah. No, they almost for sure, I think there have been even articles about it. We bombed the Chinese embassy because we're so brilliant. And this were in the peak hegemon days when there was just the assumption that there are no consequences for anything we do, and there cannot be. We bombed the Chinese embassy, and I think it's because we thought the Chinese might have been giving Serbians some kind of help or whatever, but you don't bomb their embassy. Not China, you know, that was really stupid. So yeah, they shot down this F-117. And today China has incredible technologies on their manned air. I mean, all their technologies are really good, but they have, you know, fifth generation, maybe they're even up to sixth generation, you know, fighter, stealth fighters and so on. But I'm pretty sure this has been investigated by other journalists, and it's been assumed that they got a lot of help from the Serbs handing them the F-117. I do remember some Serbian protesters against NATO, because Serbs would go out there, even though Serbs didn't like Milosevic, a lot of them didn't. But obviously when you start getting bombed, it's just like we're seeing in Iran, you know, you rally behind your country because you're being bombed.
Right.
And there was this one Serb with a kind of a mock-up of a 117, and the sign, I think it was in English, said, "Sorry, we didn't realize it was stealth."
That's really good.
That's okay. Pretty funny. So I guess the point there is that the war did not accomplish much. So Trump's threats become even more hollow and more insufferable to the rest of us, but more hollow to the Iranians. They're just not taking them seriously. And, you know, there is always that danger that a madman, a really dumb madman theorist like Trump might start to realize that he's got no credibility left, and so he needs to do something to restore madman theory credibility.
And that way lies the nukes. And that's why I've been scared recently when Trump turned over a new page in his bizarre rhetoric, which was, I don't know if I'm going to get to heaven. I don't like Trump thinking about that. Because if he thought about it for a second, he'd realize that whatever bizarre idea of heaven he has, of course he's not going to go there. But if he's even thinking about that, Trump is more of a PKD character than anybody we've had in the Oval Office, as far as I can see. And he's kind of thinking in a way that extends into the afterlife. And that is bad news for all of us.
Yep, it is. And it's kind of scary to think that he may genuinely not be thinking or caring about Americans' financial problems, that maybe I'm sure he does on some conscious level believe himself when he says that, even if some people around him might be trying to tell him you can't think that way. I'm sure it does annoy him. The thing about Trump right now, again, is just how tiresome he is. Mm. He is a bully, and he did have a comic touch of kind of, you know, a transgressive comic touch. And that comic touch is completely gone. Like when you've actually, your whole comic act is being the transgressive bully. And then you try to bully somebody and you get your ass kicked by somebody much smaller than you. And because you were an idiot, the sense that people have goes from this kind of nervous laughter to absolute loathing. And, you know, and his whole act is so tiresome and just inspired.
Yeah, that's very well put. That's the progression I've been feeling. Like, okay, he's kind of funny. And these other stuffed shirts are pretty insufferable. So let's see. And then just deepening contempt. And it never stopped deepening.
Yeah, and it gets worse and worse. And now he's off to China for a meeting with Xi Jinping. He had to cancel it once because the war was going so badly. And I think he was hoping to pull a rabbit out of his hat between the canceled meeting. And, you know, you don't cancel. I mean, it's like, I don't know. It's like you call somebody out after school, right? And then you realize you're going to get your butt kicked. So you give it 2 weeks to do some training, but you don't do any training in that time. And so you're going to go and meet them and just... No. Like, it's the whole thing is just an absolute fucking embarrassment. So he's meeting with Xi Jinping and in a humiliated state. And the general sense from countries like China, you know, this was an assumption. We talked about this with previous guests, Hamid Reza Azizi, but is that the Iranians, the Russians, the Russian elites, the Chinese elites, they all see America as a declining power that is dangerous because it's declining, because the way it's declining. And it's so evident to them. And, you know, you see things a little differently when you're in the slow boil than when you're out watching the frog turning white, I guess. But, like, if you took a longer view, if you looked at America in the year 2000, I just can't tell you for anybody who was conscious then. I mean, it was insufferable, but America's dominance was so beyond where anybody was, and its confidence, its overconfidence, and its dominance in pretty much, you know, most areas that mattered, political power, military power, cultural power, financial power, everything.
Well, yeah, some very, very important footnotes, like Trump has just casually tossed away United States technological edges and really expelled the talented foreigners who made a lot of the post-war U.S. scientific progress possible. And you see that in a lot of empires. They want to cleanse themselves of the talented foreigners, even though that is the most disastrous thing they could ever try. But they know what they know, and they're going to cleanse themselves.
I mean, they look at where America was then they saw, you know, the calamities under George W. Bush with the wars, and then, the financial crash. And then it was followed up by Obama, who was sort of kind of the restoration president, and he failed. But it was sort of like, he was going to reset the empire and America and then kind of create a new reinvigorated, whatever, America. But what was his legacy is Donald Trump. And so you've had Donald Trump and then Joe Biden, which is a complete disaster. And everybody saw it, even if like Democrats or liberals didn't want to see it. Everybody around the world saw it. They saw it as part and parcel of the same dangerous decline, and then back to Trump again. That looks like, if you're not American, and if you're maybe not even from like a real tightly close to America Western state, when you look at that from afar, this is the kind of shit you read about in history books. Like, it looks like real serious decline, whether it is or not. I think it is, but that's certainly what it looks like. And Trump's not doing anything to, you know, disabuse anybody of that notion. I mean, starting this stupid war and having no way out of it. And I don't know what he expects, you know, to get from China. We're hoping to get a really interesting China expert on really soon. We'll be able to talk about China's military and so on. But, I doubt that like Xi Jinping will be rude. I'm sure he'll try to be.
No, he doesn't have to.
Yeah, exactly.
He just has to stay the course. I mean, the easiest model for the U.S. is in the late 19th century, while Europe was building to another cataclysm, it really didn't have to do anything. But. Yeah. When you said that about Trump, I was reminded of the poem, England in 19, and I don't know if people know it well enough, so I think it might be worth reading now. And obviously, Trump is not a hereditary king exactly, but if you allow for that, it's worth it. England in 1819. This is by Shelley, by the way. An old, mad, blind, despised, and dying king. Princes, the dregs of their dull race, who flow through public scorn, mud from a muddy spring. Rulers who neither see nor feel nor know, but leech-like to their fainting country cling, till they drop blind in blood without a blow. A people starved and stabbed in the untilled field, an army which liberticide and prey makes as a two-edged sword to all who wield, golden and sanguine laws that tempt and slay, religion Christless, godless, a book sealed, a Senate, time's worst statute unrepealed. And then the last two lines, which I don't think we're... Our graves from which a glorious phantom may burst to illumine our tempestuous day. Yeah, well, maybe. But I'd go with the first 12 lines.
Yeah, that's great. Real quickly, and then I think we could probably wrap it up soon, but I just want to ask you, John, somewhat related to this, because this is when things really started to unravel, you know, it was October 7th. And so much of this kind of is so much of the acceleration of both the violence, well, all of the acceleration of both the violence and the kind of imperial insanity and decline and self destabilization and subversion and so on, really traces back to 10/7 and the reaction, the ruling class's reactions, ongoing reactions on behalf of Israel. And on behalf of its own empire. So yesterday, Nicholas Kristof, of all people, published a piece, you know, late, better late than never, I suppose, in the New York Times.
Oh, the piece on the rape.
Is that? Yes, it's called The Silence That Meets the Rape of Palestinians. Even the headline is so, I mean, it humanized Palestinians and merely stated what's fact, but has been really suppressed by media like the New York Times since forever, about which has given Israel carte blanche to do all of these horrible things, which is torture, rape, every atrocity imaginable on the non-human Palestinians. And Kristof, who is Jewish and who is, you know, a liberal human rights sort of crusader, who was pro-Iraq war, you know, who has, especially since the Iraq war debacle, kind of pivoted to focusing on victims of sexual violence and torture and kind of kept quiet about this for a very long time. And they published this. And, you know, the response is kind of what you would expect. First, the Israeli government released a response calling... accusing the New York Times of publishing, quote, one of the worst blood libels ever. You know, accusing the New York Times, the most pro-Israel, still...
Yeah.
I mean, they still
won't... It's absurd.
The New York Times still won't call it a genocide, for example. Like, if Russia had been accused by basically every single human rights organization and international court of genocide, I guarantee you every single story about Russia's war in Ukraine would be prefaced in the first one or two paragraphs with, which has been deemed a genocide, you know.
Yeah.
They're still covering for Israel in many ways, but they published this and Israel fired back by releasing a report, another one of these bullshit reports. This one is supposedly about Hamas sexual violence. So this Israeli report, Civil Commission, was timed to be released at around this, like the Israelis knew this article was coming. because Christoph and the New York Times would have spent a lot of time talking to people, calling people, checking before they'd run something like
yeah,
this.
Before they yeah. ran something like that, they would yeah. have verified every comma.
Exactly. So Israel already had something ready, which is kind of similar to previous debunked reports or deeply flawed reports alleging Hamas, including New York Times' own piece, which they yeah. which they won't officially retract, but they de facto retracted.
And our dear yes, ex-guest yes. was the big part of that.
Yes, Jeffrey Gettleman. So it released this report by something called the Civil Commission, again, claiming all this sexual violence. The author of this report, Kochav Elkayam Levy, Max pointed out, so when she's basically outed by the Israeli media as a huckster and a fraudster who kind of hustles atrocities to raise money for herself and her organization. And she was caught giving a presentation on sexual violence by Hamas. I think this was maybe even at Harvard or somewhere. And in her presentation, she showed a slide because there is, you know, for everything that was filmed on October 7th, and there's a lot of violence filmed. There was a lot of brutal yeah. violence. There's no sexual violence whatsoever. They've had to fake it. So what she did is she showed a slide, as she talked about it, of a woman raped. And it turned out to be a Kurdish YPJ woman who had been raped. And she claimed it was an Israeli woman. And, you know, she was raped by the forces that Israel backed, basically. You know, Israel's yeah. kind of with, certainly Israel's friends are with the Islamists that had raped her. So this is another one of these bullshit reports. And then the Murdoch press went wild running with it. Yeah, the Daily Mail.
In fact,
the author of the Daily Mail report on this, like they had it all laid out and ready to go. The author of the Daily Mail's report on this so-called Hamas sexual violence on October 7th, her name is Natalie Lisbona. Max just published a photo of her smiling with Netanyahu. And she is, as Max said, here's Lisbona with her de facto boss. She's had previously claimed that Palestinians burn babies and rip fetuses from pregnant women and claimed to speak to certain witnesses. And then people went to find the witnesses. They didn't exist.
Yeah, I mean, there was plenty of bad stuff happening on October 7th. But this was bad stuff of a particularly sensitive kind and led immediately to the kind of atrocities that you saw when IDF forces occupied Gaza. And talk about blood libel. There's a lot of blood behind that libel.
This is for another episode, but the whole power of anti-Semitism, both real anti-Semitism and calling somebody an anti-Semite as a slur, but also real anti-Semitism. It's just gone, thanks to Israel and Israel's dead-ender supporters. It's gone, and they don't really care. So that's why they have to rely more and more on state repression to enforce the accusation of anti-Semitism, which really is just a code word for criticizing Israel. And we even see it here. I mean, accusing the New York Times and Nicholas Kristof, a liberal Zionist, of the worst blood libel in, you know, Jewish history. It's just, screw these people.
Why blood libel anyway? What does that term mean?
I think what they mean is if you accuse Jews of committing atrocities, this is what, like, for example, I don't know, you know, in Romania 100 years ago, they on Easter, they would claim that the Jews were drinking the blood of Christian children for Passover, and then there would be pogroms and they would hang Jews on meat hooks and this kind of thing. Blood libel is sort of like anti-Semitism. It's a term that used to have powerful meaning and doesn't have any meaning anymore. I mean, what the Israelis are basically saying is, because the Israelis are very open about how they rape. We know that. They filmed it. The Israelis were filmed raping. Israelis rioted to defend the rapists, and the rapists have been turned into heroes, the rapists of Palestinian prisoners. One way they tried to debunk this was saying, because the report also, Christoph's article, citing reports by human rights, you know, investigators and doctors and so on, the Israelis used dogs to rape some of the prisoners. And then some of the, this is incredible, some of the Israeli diehards were saying, and Israelis saying, this can't be true because a dog can't rape somebody. And if people pointed out, read like the Nuremberg trials. Like, the Nazis did that to Jews, and you could read about it in like the Holocaust Museum materials. It's right there. It happened before. You of all people should know. You of all people should not be doing, you know, atrocity denial, because the Nazi atrocities against the Jews are supposed to form the kind of the moral center of the West, the post-war Western project. And, you know, everything is just upside down right now.
I don't think anybody really looks to that.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen. But
so I think it's, but I do, you know, for all of Christoph's problems, and in fact, he, I think to establish his, well, to not go against his newspaper, and perhaps he believes it, and to establish his, I'm not one of those crazy leftist bona fides. At the top of his big article, he cites Gettleman's bullshit article and says, you know, we rightly call out the sexual crimes of Hamas that were actually false and that the newspaper backtracked from, but whatever. And then, but he uses that as sort of the frame to say, but we, if we're going to do that, we must also call out the Israeli crimes. And for all the faults of Christoph and even that article, this means, you know, you can't turn away from it now. Even that audience, like we like to believe, well, it's true that in the internet age that, you know, legacy media has less power to completely shape opinion, but it still has enormous power in, it still retains enormous power. And, you know, I don't know what could ever be done about that. We all recognize that, because power in this country reads the New York Times. And so if that means that power, real power, people who aren't our friends, you know, people who are super rich and super powerful, and people who love Israel and hate Palestinians and whatever, or people who are, you know, pained by what Israel's doing, but don't really want to acknowledge everything because it causes you to wince. They have to look at it now.
Right.
And that means a lot.
I read a book by Christoph about his interpreter. It was a Sagawa from southwestern Sudan. And it was a pretty good ghost-written book. He's always been, I think, one of the better elite stooges.
Yeah, I mean, I think that he's, I guess the word would be he's a little less cynical than some of the others, you know?
And
I just think for somebody like him, you can't ignore this for so long when there's all this evidence out there and there are other people writing about it and there are documentaries and so on. You can't be quiet about it. You have to be a lot more cynical, like Samantha Power or something, for example, who, you know, who built her entire CV on genocide, on calling out how no one will acknowledge certain genocides or do anything about it. And then when she had the power to do something about it, she deliberately did nothing.
Yeah, and that is perhaps the most egregious example that's come up recently.
But
I wonder what happens when people run into her at some DC party. Don't bear thinking about it. Anyway.
I think there have been people who go to some of these things and call out and yell at and call out. I know Blinken's been dogged some. Jake Sullivan, I think, maybe has been dogged a little bit by protesters. who kind of muck up their elite little gatherings where they have their little pencil microphones.
Yeah, that's right. I saw some of that. That is a satisfying moment.
It is, yeah. And may they happen more often. Yeah. Anyway, I think we can wrap it up here, right?
Yep, yeah.
It's grim, but that is a potentially positive sign that the New York Times ran that.
Yeah, and it can't last forever.
Yeah.
And that's kind of cheering news.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks All again, right. John. Thanks, Brendan. And thank you, everybody. Talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.